Yep, you may proceed.
Thanks very much, Your Honor. And I'd like to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal. May it please the court, Alan Schoenfeld for JPMorgan Chase. Everyone agrees that as applied to loans held by federal savings associations, California's interest on escrow law is preempted by HOLA and its implementing rules. Chase is not a federal savings association, and so plaintiffs argue that once Washington Mutual sold its loans to Chase, WaMu's status as a thrift and the power of thrifts to sell mortgages under HOLA, free from state law restrictions, became irrelevant. In other words, on plaintiff's view, HOLA's field preemption of state laws restricting the ability of savings associations to sell loans ceased to apply, and California's interest on escrow law started to apply as soon as plaintiff's mortgages were sold. That view can't be correct under HOLA and the OTS regulations. As this court explained in Silvis, the proper analysis in evaluating whether a state law is preempted under the OTS preemption regulation, section 560.2, begins with the categories of state law listed in 560.2b. If the state law restriction is found there, the analysis ends there too. The law is preempted, and that's precisely this case.
Can I ask a question about the regulation 560.2? In the Lusnak decision, our court, it wasn't the exact same regulation. I guess it actually was a regulation under the National Banking Act. But the panel held in Lusnak that that was not entitled, well, they said little, if any, deference under Skidmore. Do you disagree with that? Do you think that there's more a deference that's due to the regulation 560.2 here?
I do, Your Honor. You know, Congress gave the Office of Thrift Supervision. And again, I don't think there's any dispute in this case that we're dealing with the OTS reg because these contracts were entered into prior to the effective date of Dodd-Frank. So we're talking about the...
And that was different in Lusnak, right? Lusnak was... I think Lusnak applied Dodd-Frank.
I think it did. It applied certain provisions of Dodd-Frank, 1639, the TILA provision. But to answer the question you initially asked, Congress vested OTS's predecessor and ultimately OTS with the authority to preempt the field. So I think the question of what type of deference the regulation gets... I apologize, Judge Wynn.
I was going to ask about 560.2, though, which you seem to rely upon. And then I'll ask as well about the statutory authority for 560. 560 says that OTS occupies the entire field of lending regulation for federal savings associations. I mean, almost by definition, this question of state escrow interest isn't related to lending regulation associated with federal savings associations, is it?
Well, so
it deals with escrow interest on national banks.
So 560.2a, what Your Honor just quoted, is a broad statement of the regulations preemptive force. And I think what the Supreme Court has made clear since the Planters case is that the power to lend entails the power to sell. And so what we see in 560.2b is an enumeration of categories of state law that OTS concluded are preempted as applied to federal savings associations.
Follow along with me on 560b2. That's the controlling provision, right?
Yep.
And that, well, I'm referring now to 12 U.S.C. 1463, which is the underlying statute, right?
I think it's 1463 and 1464, correct.
So the authority to pass a regulation is under B2, right? 1463B2.
So I think there's also 1464C1. Which refers to express authority that says, to the extent specified in regulations of the controller, now the controller, previously OTS, a federal savings association may invest in, sell, or otherwise deal in the following loans and other investments. And I think that's part of the source of OTS's authority.
But here we're not talking. There's no effort by California to stop the sale of these federal loans. It's just an and it's not even an effort by California to impose escrow interest on loans held by federal savings and loans. It's just an effort to impose interest on escrow monies held by national banks.
So the submission in this case is that the application of this California statute interferes with or is regulates or otherwise affects, which is the language of 560.2A, the ability of federal savings associations to sell mortgage loans. And so
they challenge whether it has any impact. You're actually asking for a bit of an advantage over federal banks that come up with mortgages.
This seems like it would have a massive impact in the marketplace, wouldn't it? I mean, you're talking about all these banks that are originated without requiring to pay interest. I mean, how much are the plaintiffs seeking here in damages?
So we know that the plaintiffs are seeking at least $5 million in damages because they
assert $5 million?
$5 million because they assert CAFA jurisdiction. But the Luznak case, for example, which was also a California-only class, settled for either $30 or $35 million with a promise.
And that's just one bank.
One bank in just one state.
So we're talking about billions of dollars out in the market that would have to be accounted for in some way by reselling these loans, right? I mean, obviously, if you have a loan where you don't have to collect interest and you have to resell it where they have to pay interest, they're not going to pay as much for that.
I think that's precisely right, Your Honor, and I think it's worth remembering that part of the purpose of the Homeowners Lending Act or the Homeowners Loan Act was to establish federal savings associations that would deal in mortgages, and the ability of the FSAs, federal savings associations, to sell those mortgages in order to free up cash and lend more.
At the time the law was passed, mortgages weren't even sold. It was passed in 33.
It was passed in 33.
And mortgages weren't sold until sometime later.
Well, so the first regulation specifically addressing the ability of thrifts to sell loans was enacted in 1938. So it was a short time after the original enactment of HOLA. But Congress has over time explicitly recognized the importance of FSAs being able to sell mortgages. The operative provision here, the ones that Your Honor and I just went back and forth on, 1463 and 1464, were enacted in 1978. And so since at least that time, and I think there's no question that that's the version of HOLA that governs this case, since at least that time, Congress has recognized that FSAs have a federally authorized power to sell loans, and OTS has recognized in its preemption regulation that all state laws that would purport to regulate or otherwise affect the ability of an FSA to sell a loan are preempted. And so for the reasons that, for the precise reasons that Judge Nelson mentioned.
What statutory authority says that any law that would affect the ability to sell loans?
That's 560.2A. So 1464 is what gives OTS the authority to promulgate a regulation relating to federal thrift's ability to sell mortgages. And then 560.2A specifically says federal savings associations may extend credit as authorized under federal law, including this part, without regard to state laws purporting to regulate or otherwise affect their credit activities. And then 560.2B is a set of illustrative examples of state law requirements that OTS has concluded would in fact accomplish those ends and so are impermissible as applied to federal savings associations.
And so let me take you just to a bit of question. Is there under Auer or Kaiser, are you saying that the Office of Thrift Supervisor or it has the ability to basically come up with any regulation that might in some ways help federal thrifts?
So with respect to the OTS regulation, I don't think Auer or Kaiser is implicated. that would relate to the agency's interpretation of its own regulation, which I think would go to the opinion letters. But to answer your question directly, the Supreme Court made entirely clear in De La Cuesta that this is a field preemptive regime. It is a rare type of preemptive regime, but it does apply to federal threats. And I think, as this court recognized in Silvis and the San Francisco
when case, you said field when you mentioned field preemptive, it deals with complete preemption of state regulation of federal threats.
I think that's exactly right. And I think the question here, as the court put the question in Campidoglio, is whether a restriction on the ability of a federal thrift to sell a loan, including by imposing substantively different financial terms on the purchaser. And I think it's worth pointing out in this respect that the California statute at issue here, 2954.8, only applies to Chase because the statute on its face says it applies to purchasers of mortgages. And so it is expressly regulating Chase as the purchaser. And because it regulates Chase as the purchaser, it necessarily has implications for the federal thrift as the seller. And so it interferes with or purports to regulate or otherwise affects the ability of the thrift
Chase,
to sell its loans.
Does Chase buy loans from other federal banks?
I don't know the answer to that question. I mean, this obviously involves a very large purchase of loans when WaMu failed in 2008, but I don't know the answer to your question, Your Honor.
Can I ask a question? Midland, the Second Circuit in the Midland funding case, they came out the other way, arguably the other way, but that was under the National Banking Act. And they said that, which applies conflict preemption, not field preemption. If we were to find this preempted in this case, would we be in conflict with Midland funding?
No, not at all, because for the reason that you just gave, this is a case about HOLA preemption, whereas Midland was about the National Bank Act. I think there's one important similarity, however, there would be one similarity if the court were to adopt our reasoning between this case and Midland, which is as follows. Midland Funding is not a national bank. It's a third-party debt purchaser. And the court in that case considered whether the National Bank Act preempted the state usury cap as applied to Midland because it understood at bottom that the question was whether application of the state law to Midland would prevent or significantly interfere under Barnett Bank with the national bank originator's ability to sell their loans. That's precisely the way that the court should frame the question here. The question is whether application of this state law requirement to mortgages originated by a federal savings association would interfere with the federal savings association's ability to sell their loans. And so the question is framed identically in both cases, but that case reached a different conclusion because the National Bank Act applied, whereas it does not apply here.
With the Dodd-Frank, the issue's gone away, hasn't it, with regard to loans that would be generated by federal thrifts now.
Yeah, for mortgages.
So this is just for, it's just for, it's just, so your argument in general is we are going to have to pay interest on loans that we purchase from here on from federal thrifts, but the mere fact that we have to pay interest on escrow accounts for loans that we purchased in the past might in the future make it more difficult for federal thrifts to sell future loans.
So it's an odd kind of ahistorical question. I think the question is, when Chase acquired these loans in 2008, did it assume an obligation under either federal preemption law or the mortgages to pay interest on escrow? And because application of that obligation or imposition of that obligation would have interfered with the thrift's ability to sell mortgages, it was preempted under the prevailing regulation at the time.
Well, the district court here made the decision that it would only be forward, right? You'd only have to pay this escrow on balances held on your accounts going forward, escrow balances that customers kept with you.
So I don't think there was any dispute in the district court as to whether there was an obligation for Chase to pay interest on escrow for the loans during the time that they were held on WAMU. I think those claims probably would have been time barred, but in any event, I believe we can certainly ask my friend on the other side, but I don't think there was any argument that WAMU was ever under an obligation to pay interest on escrow during the times that they held these loans that they had originated.
Yeah, because they're a federal thrift, unlike Chase.
I understand Your Honor's point, but our submission here is that what matters for purposes of the preemption analysis, as this court approached the question in Campidoglio, and as Justice Nelson pointed out, I think the Second Circuit approached the question in Madden, when you impose the state law requirement, you are trenching on terrain that OTS has said is preempted because it affects the ability of a thrift to sell loans in the market. I see my time is up. I'm happy to answer.
Yeah, no, we'll give you time for rebuttal. So thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you very much, Glenn Danis from Robbins Kaplan for appellee Mechanic. So there are five reasons here why California Civil Code 2954.8 is not preempted by HOLA. Number one, as applied to Chase, a national bank would simply be outside the scope of Congress's delegation of power to the agency in its former delegation of power to former OTS 560. Number two, where there is a mere incidental effect on an actor within the field, where there's a mere incidental effect outside the field, under Supreme Court case law, the Travelers case from 1995, that speaks to the fact that it's not going to be preempted even under a field preemption analysis. Number three is there would be no conflict preemption here, and there would in fact most likely be a conflict with the other panel decision in Lesnack, given the fact that here there is in fact another set of regulations, the National Bank Act, that applies to banks for their own conduct. That is in fact what we have here, and we've already found, or this court has already found, that there is no conflict between 2954.8 and the National Bank Act, which applies to Chase for its own conduct. Number four, there's no congressional intent whatsoever to show that preemption should attach to a loan as it travels to a national bank for its own conduct. And in fact, one of the questions earlier about the level of deference involved, I think, is precisely a good one, given that the Kaiser case from 2019 severely limited our deference. And here, the only two even possible points of congressional intent that are pointed to by Chase are two opinion letters that say nothing about whether the loan would actually take preemption with it to subsequent non-Federal Savings Association buyers. And number five, there's simply no contract basis in order to apply.
So can I jump in? Because I think, the deference point, I think you're right that there's probably little, if any, deference. But I view this, no one had really focused on this in any of the prior opinions, but the Solicitor General, this was Solicitor General Verrilli under President Obama, when they filed, they filed an amicus brief in the Supreme Court, and they ultimately told the court not to take Midland funding, but they said specifically when Congress enacted Section 85 of the MBA, at the earliest statutory antecedent, it was already established that a bank's power to sell loans was a necessarily implied corollary of the power to originate loans. And that cites to the Planters Bank of Mississippi versus Sharp, a 1948 Supreme Court case. It seems to me that that is sort of the key here. If it's true that the ability to sell is implied within the ability to originate, then doesn't that sort of answer the question? Because there's no disagreement that there is preemption for the in the first origination in this case. The question is, does that transfer to the successor in interest, right?
That's correct, Your Honor.
what I'm confused on is why no court has really, since, I mean, even Lesnack didn't didn't grapple with this. And maybe they didn't need to be, you know, to reach their conclusion, but the district court didn't grapple with this at all. But the Solicitor General's view seems far more consistent with an analysis of preemption that doesn't rely on deference to the regulation, but just a standard theory that if you have the power to originate, you also have the power to transfer, and that this impinges upon that. And that, by the way, was in a case where it was conflict preemption. And they said that conflict preemption, the Solicitor General's position was conflict preemption applied in the MVA. We have field preemption. So I don't understand why it wouldn't even be a greater impact of preemption in this case. Anyway, long-winded question, but I'm interested in your answer.
Yeah, well, I would say a couple of things to that. Number one is, I would point this court to the Traveler's opinion in 514 U.S. 645, a U.S. Supreme Court case dealing with ERISA. Now, I know my colleague on the other side attempted to distinguish that in their reply brief, in a footnote saying that, well, you know, that case had to do with ERISA. ERISA's preemption is different. But the Traveler's decision allowed a New York state law to impose massive costs on insurance companies that would have an indirect effect on the cost or the attractiveness of those insurance companies to ERISA-governed plans. And there they found no preemption because the field there of ERISA was about ERISA plans, and this was not a direct regulation of ERISA plans. Likewise here, no one is saying that a Federal Savings Association doesn't have a right to sell loans. This regulation, California's escrow law, would merely make it slightly less attractive down the road in the secondary market, and put it on the same footing, not only as all other loans that it might be bought from other.
Let me push back on that, because the Solicitor General, in the Midland Funding case, specifically rejected that argument as well. And again, that was a conflict preemption case where you had to find that it prevents. Prevents was the key term. Prevents the ability to engage in the activity that's permitted. And the Solicitor General argued that even under the prevents theory, that preemption applied. Here you've got, with field preemption, you've got any ancillary effect. And I don't understand how we shouldn't take the Solicitor General's views into account here, when they're the ones in the best position, it seems to me, to determine what was the purpose of the statute. And I mean, the National Banking Act was adopted in the 1800s, 1868. That was 80 years before there was even a secondary market for these things. And, you know, now we're talking about HOLA, which was adopted 5 years before. And it just strikes me that's pretty conclusive that there was an intent or should be an intent to countenance preemption in this context.
Well, my answer to that would be several things. Number one is, although that might have been the U.S. Solicitor General's brief, I believe that would set up a direct intra-circuit conflict with Madden to find otherwise, and to find that there is, in fact, conflict preemption here because of it. Number two...
Well, we don't have to find conflict. That's my point. We don't have to find conflict preemption.
Well,
we have field preemption. So, but I am interested in your views. If we were to find preemption here, your view is it would be in conflict with Midland Funding from the Second Circuit.
Well, it would be in conflict with Midland Funding, and it would also be in conflict with Lesnack, I believe. But my greater point is that there is not field preemption here. And even if there were some way of saying that this is within the field of regulating a savings association, by in fact doing nothing of the sort and placing a restriction on a national bank for its own conduct. Even within HOLA, if you look at section 560.2C, it says that certain state laws that directly affect a federal savings association can be will not be preempted under field preemption if it's incidental or if the effect is incidental. Here we
well, but that I think that's sort of my point, is that aren't we looking at an incidental standard, whereas Midland Funding was looking at a, quote, prevents standard?
Well, I think that all of them would be under, I take your Honor's point, and I think I see what you're saying. It is an incidental standard if you're going to find that this is within the realm of field preemption. So if you're going to find that the field includes...
How can we, so let me push back on that. How can we not find that it's within the context? Because, I mean, even Midland Funding didn't say it was outside of the context. It just said it didn't transfer to a successor in interest. And the Supreme and the Solicitor General specifically found that these escrow payments were within the field. And they found that there was conflict.
Well, so, I think that they were not doing a field analysis there.
No, they weren't. But that's my point, is... If they were finding that it was in conflict, under a lesser standard, how can it not be part of the field when we're talking about field preemption? I mean, nobody's debated that this isn't part of the field.
Because the answer, those are two different questions and two different types of questions. Whether it falls within the field is dependent on the statute, the words of the statute, and the intent of Congress. There is not there's not one iota of statutory support for extending to a national bank for its own conduct the field of HOLA preemption, and there is not one iota of congressional intent to do that either. The best that opposing counsel was able to come up with being those two very sparse, and for reasons that I won't waste time on, opinions that
so
would
your
not
view is that that's not, your view is that that's different under HOLA than it is under the National Banking Act. That the field, if you will, is a different field. That for some reason, in your view, the National Banking Act has a broader field of what it preempts, even though it requires conflict and not field preemption. Whereas under a HOLA, even though there's field preemption, the field is narrower. Is that what you're arguing?
I think that's one way of looking at it, and I would say that whether it falls within the field of National Bank Act jurisdiction doesn't answer the question. The question there, of course, as Your Honor said, is whether it creates a barrier to the obstacles and objectives of Congress. And there, we already have the answer in this circuit. It's no, with respect to the same statute. With respect to field preemption, I'm just trying
to give... Wait, hold on. With respect to this, back up. With respect to the same statute, what case is that? That's not Lesnack.
That's Lesnack. With respect to...
I thought Lesnack was a National Banking Act.
No. The statute I'm talking about is preemption of the same California regulation.
Okay. Got it.
But I guess what I would say is that with respect to field, I'm just trying to give Your Honors some bases for saying that even within a field preemption analysis, even if you found that this was within the field, it would still not be preempted if it only posed an incidental effect. And here, not only does HOLA itself have in it a section for incidental effects that are not preempted where they directly regulate an FSA, under 560.2C, but there's also the Travelers case and U.S. Supreme Court Oniok case from 2015 that say what's an incident. Oh, I'm sorry.
Let me try to address some questions on the Kaiser, because we're talking here about 560.2. Under Kaiser, is a regulating agency allowed to issue a regulation if it doesn't... find support in the underlying statute?
No. So to answer your
honor, but and even going back, part of the issue here is this 2003 opinion letter. The opinion letter didn't actually deal with this same question as to this. The question posed in the opinion letter didn't actually deal with the preemption from state interest laws, did it?
No, Your Honor.
It dealt with the New Jersey, New York State, but both of them owned by the same savings association, right?
Correct.
And so they posited an additional question, and in that question they asked whether it could transfer beyond But let me take you to this. The 2003 opinion letter, is it only valid if it if the underlying regulation's uncertain?
Yes. So as Justice Gorsuch said, our deference after Kaiser has been maimed and enfeebled. And the new standard that's applied is whether or not it first has to be ambiguous, and second, it has to be reasonable. Third, the interpretation has to be show by its character and context that it's worth deference.
Well, just going to 560.2, the 12 CFR, is that ambiguous about that the 2003 letter would respond to some ambiguity?
Not even remotely. I don't think that those letters have any bearing on it, because there would have to be an ambiguity as to whether, in fact, that 560 applies to a national bank for its own conduct, and there is none.
So I view those letters as effectively an amicus brief of sorts. Is that the proper way we should look at it? To the extent they're persuasive, to the extent they got it right, we can consider them. But
well,
give deference to them.
Your Honor, I guess I would say this. If either of those letters had dealt with the question that we're dealing with here, which is whether preemption would travel to a non-FSA for its own conduct, I would say, you know, sure. And then it would depend on how well-reasoned they were, whether it purported to be the agency's definitive determination, et cetera, et cetera. Here, in both of those letters, it was merely an afterthought, and neither of them said anything about applying preemption to another non-federal savings association for its own conduct. One of them seemed like it was potentially saying that it might go to a third party, and if someone was attempting to sue the federal savings association while it was held by the third party, that there could still be a preemption defense, and it might have traveled for that purpose. Neither of those letters spoke to this problem.
I know you're out of time, but don't, you know, you can answer all the questions we have. The district court below reversed himself in a way, right? 6 years earlier, he said that it was preempted. What changed? I mean, obviously the one thing that changed was there were more district court opinions, but I found it very interesting that he didn't look below to grapple with, he didn't even look to Midland Funding or look to the Solicitor General's views before the Supreme Court. It just sort of seemed to take temperature of what other district courts were doing and where the flow was from the district courts. Could you address why you think that he changed his view on this?
Sure. One reason might be the fact that Dodd-Frank has made this question really esoteric at this point. Because there really isn't a great potential for unleashing a terrible kind of tidal wave of upset contracts. Because essentially, even if this had any kind of important effect, which it doesn't, it only relates to mortgages that are pre-2010 and that were sold to national banks afterwards. But I think the district court here was motivated more by the fact that HOLA itself is a consumer statute, a consumer protection statute. And was really a height of sort of a New Deal, help the little guy, help the homeowner kind of statute. And therefore, he was really saying that to allow it to be used by a national bank to shield its own conduct would be sort of a perverse and really counterintuitive way of viewing it. So I think that was number one. And the second reason, I think, is we in our briefing got deep into the legislative history. He was really concerned here, and we had supplemental briefing where both of us, opposing counsel and us, submitted briefs where we both agreed that there was nothing in HOLA at all, or even known in the financial markets at the time, where mortgages were being sold on a secondary market. And even in the many years since then, while HOLA did amend itself 50 years later to allow for sale of mortgages, never said anything about whether preemption would travel to non-federal savings associations for its own conduct. At most, it said that this is something that a bank, a federal savings association, can do in the 1978 amendments. And that's a far cry from there being a clear congressional mandate for this sort of preemption to take the states to preempt them acting in their traditional police powers. display state law, which frankly would be to really upset a very delicate federalism balance.
Okay. Judge Wallace or Judge Quinn, do you have any further questions?
No, no, thank you.
Okay, thank you, counsel. And we'll
let me say it was a pleasure to hear you two argue. whatever your pay is, it's not enough. It's just good to hear people come and know their case and difficult ones. Whichever way this comes out, you've done a good job for your clients and for the court. Thank you
very much, Your Honor.
Well, and Judge Wallace might have jumped ahead a little bit because we still got. don't blow it in your rebuttal. He's already congratulated you. So
yeah, I'll try to keep it brief and good. But I want to make really 3 points. The first one is there was obviously a lot of discussion about how this is a field preemptive regime, which begs the question of what the field entails. And what's clear from HOLA as it has been amended over time, and what's clear from the OTS regulation, is that the field very importantly includes the ability of federal savings associations to sell loans in the secondary market. We cite ample authority for that proposition in our briefs. The regulators, very shortly after HOLA was enacted, implemented a regulation making sure that FSA's authority to sell loans to ensure liquidity in the marketplace was clear. Congress then enacted a version of HOLA in 1978, which governs here, which made the ability to sell loans unfettered. There was a cap of 25% in the initial regulations, and Congress lifted that cap. So the field includes the ability to sell. I was going to say, I think I addressed in my initial argument, I don't think there's any conflict here with Madden or Luznak for the important reason that both of them concern the National Bank Act. And Luznak made very clear in its opinion that HOLA is a different regime and that it wasn't opining on how the question may have come out under HOLA. With respect to the analysis, once you are within the field of what is preempted under HOLA preemption, I heard my friend on the other side say that there is that the application of this state law would make loans slightly less attractive to an FSA purchaser. I think he vastly understates the impact, but in a field preemptive regime, making the sale proposition slightly less attractive is enough to trigger preemption. There are two important ways that I think, and I promise I'll hurry up and finish up here, but there are two important ways that I think it makes the sale more difficult. One is it strips a very important financial term that is part of the mortgage from the FSA's bargain. It cannot sell its loan at full value to a non-FSA purchaser, whether a national bank or otherwise. The other important thing it does is it constrains the market. If an FSA cannot sell a loan to another party except another FSA with the full terms of the mortgage and the full value intact, the marketplace for FSA-originated loans is constrained because you only have another FSA as a potential purchaser. Finally, let me just say one thing on Kaiser. Kaiser doesn't apply to the deference that is due to a full dress regulation. It applies to what our apply to, which is agency interpretations of regulations.
Let me go to that, because 560.2, when was that enacted?
So I think 1996 was the version, I apologize,
that we're currently dealing with, right?
I think there may have been amendments in between, but we're basically talking about a regulation that was promulgated in 1996.
Okay, they had the earlier decision talking about transferability of the preemption. Why didn't they include some statement saying that people who purchased these loans would enjoy the same avoidance of state regulation?
So I guess I don't know the answer to that, but let me offer two observations which I hope help. The first one is OTS, in promulgating its regulation in 1996, and we cite the Federal Register commentary on this, said, we are carrying forward precisely the same preemption regime that operated beforehand. And I think that carries forward agency.
Well, why wouldn't they have been explicit if they intended to carry the 2003 opinion letter into it?
Well, so the 2003 opinion letter postdates the promulgation of this regulation, and OTS, citing back to the 1985 letter, had no difficulty saying the preemption regulation as it stands incorporates this baseline common law principle that, you know, the rights of the assignee or the purchaser are the same as the rights of the assignor. And so the same preemption rules that apply to the assignor or the originator ought to apply to the purchaser or the assignee standing in his shoes.
But the language of the preemption still talks about preempting for the federal thrift industry, right?
I don't dispute that it applies on its face to FSAs, but the question is, it applies to the FSA's ability to sell. So the question here is, I think the court put it in Campidoglio, and as the court, you know, certainly recognized in Madden, is the ability of the relevant federally regulated financial institution to sell its loan with maximum flexibility, free from state intervention, interfered with or affected by a state law requirement imposed on a third party purchaser?
Okay. Absent further questions, I think we've got the arguments. You guys, both counsel have been exceptional, yeah, as Judge Wallace already mentioned. So
thank you very much, Your Honor.
Thank you. All right.
Stay safe.
Thank you.
The case is submitted.
Again.
Thank you.